Hi, everyone, and welcome to today's episode. Today, we're joined by Oliver Windrum, co-founder and CTO of Coronga, as they explore how technology can both empower small-scale farmers towards improved agricultural outcomes and also limit food waste globally and within the African continent. Hi, Oliver. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for inviting me to join you.
So how we typically start our episodes is by you introducing yourself to the audience. Do you mind giving us a quick overview of your personal background and your journey to your role as CTO of Coronga?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a Zimbabwean. So I grew up in Zimbabwe on what was at the time the largest tomato farm in and around Harare, which is the capital. So I grew up embedded in African agriculture. And at the time, I went to boarding school and I actually met my CEO, who's my co-founder, Tendai Chitapi, at school. So we've known each other for a long time. When we had finished up our A-levels, Tendai basically went off to do his articles and become a CA. And I went off to Cape Town. I did initially a degree in chemical, molecular, and cellular sciences. So I was very focused on biology. And then after that, I ended up going to the UK, to the University of Warwick, to do a PhD in plant and environmental sciences. And that sort of gave me a really good grounding in terms of how plants are interacting and responding to their environment and to pathogens. So I developed sort of this very high-level molecular and systems biology level understanding of how plants are interacting with their environments. And then I ended up doing a postdoc after that in synthetic biology. I actually transitioned to a yeast, and I was studying a very similar molecular system, but instead of observing it, we were trying to re-engineer and transition this yeast into a new state of production capacity. We were using them for making artificial proteins. And after that, I decided to sort of combine my experience in systems and synthetic biology, and I applied and wrote a fellowship to NERC, which was like this research council in the UK, and I got an independent fellowship to also follow up at Imperial, where I did my PhD, became this independent research fellow, and I was basically studying how plants are responding at the environmental level to different stresses and developing new ways of breeding them to basically engineer new levels of stress tolerance to rapid environmental change that we were starting to see plants experiencing in the natural world, but also in, obviously, in agriculture.
Curious to know what your conclusions from that study was. Were you able to see that program and research to completion?
What basically happened, there was a bit of chaos during, you know, lockdown. I think a whole lot of plants that I had been looking after for well on 2 or 3 years, we had been setting some seed and there were some vital lines, and they all ended up dying in the first few months of COVID. So a lot of my work for my fellowship went down the drain. but at the same time, actually, and before this, I had started wanting to get back to working in Africa. And I'd seen there was a path to deploying this high-end biotech that I was developing globally, and potentially in Africa, but I could see a number of roadblocks to their deployment.
It's really great hearing about your journey. You're a Zimbabwean, you were raised there, and your family was very embedded in their agricultural sector. And it sounds to me that that had an influence on you and your educational pursuits, your bachelor's and then your PhD and your research. And I'm really sorry to hear about what happened during COVID, but it's interesting how that allowed you to pivot to something new with Coronga. So did you always see yourself taking the entrepreneurial route, or was this just an opportunity to dive into something that was completely different?
So, I mean, I was actually involved in the founding of a sort of high-tech agricultural startup in about, I think we founded in 2013. They're now Sound Agriculture, and I think they, 2022, they closed their Series C for like $70 million or something. But I was involved in sort of helping to develop the initial key technology for that, which is basically a biomolecule that enhances drought tolerance in dry land corn. And the main sort of market for that is the Midwest, where a whole lot of dry land corn is grown. And that was very much closer to my key expertise, which is molecular biology. And that was very exciting, and it's always been very interesting. But I took a backseat advisory role for that because I had sort of the key plant expertise for the founding team. But I noticed that you can do really cool science in labs, and you're not really deviating from academic pursuits in science. And I think that was my initial hesitation with the startup world, as I thought, I think it's this generally projected concept in academia that applied science is somehow beneath fundamental science, right? But in reality, there's some amazing and really exciting work that goes on, particularly in startups now, both in biotech, but also in AI, where we've transitioned into. So I definitely saw this as a route I wanted to take. At the time, I think when I was an academic, I wanted to sort of see if I could maybe launch a spin out through the university. But in retrospect, no, I'm really glad that I dived in and went all the way, because one of the sort of key things I've learned, both as an academic and now in startup, is it really helps to be able to focus on a singular objective and not be distracted by additional pursuits. So diving all the way in has definitely been the best way for me to sort of launch a startup.
We're back here with Oliver Windrum, and he's just walked us through his journey from his time in Zimbabwe to his research experience in UK and now settling here in Houston, Texas. Now, we actually want to know what Karunga is. It's a startup, but what is the mission of this startup? What's the larger goal? Can you walk us through the details of this company?
Okay, yeah, sure. So I'd say the main thing, we don't actually talk about it a lot to farmers and buyers in our day-to-day business, but one of our key mission goals is to reduce food waste with Karunga. And it's brought about by these sort of rather remarkable statistics in Africa. So I'd say in developed economies, a lot of people have probably heard the statistic where about a third of the food that we buy ends up going in the bin. So that's sort of post-consumer purchase food waste that I think many people are probably familiar with, and it's something we're all trying to deal with and reduce. But in Africa, there's actually a pre-market, post-harvest, but pre-getting to market food waste statistic that is usually about 40%, but it can reach 60%, sometimes even 100% in unique circumstances, where farmers will harvest, but they won't be able to find a market to sell food that's perfectly edible and humans can eat it. So you know, if you're looking at it from a sustainability point of view, and we're worried about feeding the next 2 billion people that are going to come along, in Africa, we can do that now simply by optimizing the way food is getting to markets and making sure it's eaten by people. So there are various problematic sort of dysfunctionalities that exist in markets today that are leading to what I think is an atrocious level of food waste. But it's not really anything that I think individually farmers can necessarily achieve. And the reasons we think this is, well, we're sort of confident now we understand why this is occurring, is down to the fact that these small-scale growers, I think I may or may not have already mentioned this, but 60% of land in Africa is managed by small-scale growers. And by that, I mean someone on about 5 hectares or less. So that's 60% of land by area. So this huge proportion of land productivity, potential, and actual production is managed by these small-scale growers, but they are typically not representative to a significant extent in commercial markets in Africa. Most of the commercial markets in reality are being served by large-scale producers. So people operating on 20, 50 hectare plus. So medium to sort of large scale farms. So what's classified as a large scale farm in Africa is slightly different from what might be a large scale farm in the US. So with that in mind, we wanted to try and understand what can we do to help farmers basically engage with markets in a more proactive and sustainable way that leads to better business practice on both sides. And there are these two pinnacles points of failure that we've observed. And one is that farmers are simply not grading properly at the farm gate. So that may not, and that doesn't mean that they can't grade. It just means that they're not grading appropriately for the market they want to serve. So they may be growing this amazing produce, but then they're sending it to a second-grade market and getting second-grade prices. Or they may be harvesting first and second-grade produce and then putting it all in one box and then trying to sell it to a first-grade market, which leads to these very high rejection rates. So there's a need to match quality to the market. And that's the first hurdle that we're trying to help farmers with. And right now, we're going through sort of a customer education phase of showing farmers what grading means. So we have experts in the company that basically provide grading advice of how to improve the quality, but also how to standardize that quality for them to get the best possible price at markets.
And how exactly are you doing that?
So we're meeting farmers where they are currently and trying to help them improve their grading practice. But the way that works is, ultimately, we're gathering this image data and we're labeling it through human experts that are buyers on our platform, but also people that are working within Kuronga to label data and grade data. So we're building labeling data for these grading systems. And we've realized that a lot of people have said, why don't you just go out and get publicly available data and build models? But the reality is that a lot of the grading is so nuanced and specific to different markets, you have to build up systems and label data that can accommodate for the fact that one person's first grade is not the same as the next. So that's the main service we're developing now. We're helping farmers understand grading with a future concept of we're going to be using this data to build AI that can basically perform grading at the farm gate while harvesting is happening, and then allocating that to the correct market so that a farmer picks a whole lot of stuff, they put it into a box, they take a photo with their smartphone, and then it says, okay, this is first class, this should go to market A, or this is second class, this needs to go to market B. So that's sort of the key fundamental innovation of what we're pushing through at the moment.
Wow, Oliver, that's very impressive. I can see a lot of farmers getting value from such a tool that's provided through the Kuronga platform. You've mentioned there were two objectives. So can you walk us through what the second objective is?
The second sort of handbrake that a lot of these small-scale farmers have is that individually they can't really provide consistent supply. And consistent supply is basically delivering a fixed quality of a fixed amount to the market consistently throughout the month or throughout the week. So because of the way planning happens on small-scale farms, and simply because of their limitations in surface area for growing stuff, they can't actually do that on a daily or weekly basis. Often, most farmers will come in once or twice a month, and it's never really consistent because they don't have a production system in place that enables that. There's just too much variation in biology and production to achieve that. So what we're doing now is we've got farmers signed up to a winter production program. We get them to use standardized genetics. So we've partnered with some good seed providers. We've actually got people outsourcing the germination and management of the initial seedlings. So we help to standardize the production of the seedlings. But then we also have a detailed planting and plant management guidance system that we send automated notifications to farmers and farm managers every day, and they have to upload evidence. In particular, the farm managers have to upload physical evidence to show us that particular interventions and crop protection and crop maintenance implementations have taken place on the farm. And this is important because it helps to standardize quality, but it also helps to ensure the crop is ready at the right time for delivery to market. And we stagger the planting across farmers. So collectively, this cooperative of farmers are now functioning as a large-scale enterprise. So they can deliver on schedule every month. It may not be the same farmer delivering every day, but collectively, they deliver more consistently over time. And because it's tied in with our grading that happens at the farm gate, we're delivering this consistent supply with this consistent quality over time, which is what the buyers are looking for at market.
Thanks for that very detailed breakdown and outline of your mission and goals. So what I'm getting from this is that you're focused on small-scale farmers, and that's often classified by them owning less than 5 hectares of land, as you said. Now, if the focus is on these farmers, you're also providing the tech and the support to allow them to adequately grade their crops and also connect them with the larger marketplace where they can sell the crops, and you're also helping them improve their output. So can you walk us through what products you're offering to fulfill these needs? You mentioned a smartphone earlier, so I'm assuming there's an app for this, but can you give us some detail around the actual software products and other services that you offer specifically that'll support these small-scale farmers on the African continent?
Okay, yeah. So if any of the listeners are familiar with SAFs, we have a subscription model system that'll look quite familiar. So we have a freemium tier level where basically farmers can upload pictures of their produce and get grading advice for free. And that's a way for us to gather data. So the value add to us is we're gathering data and we're labeling data for future model training. And first sort of paid level subscription is, you know, we're charging farmers about $15 a month. And for a bit of context, your earning per hectare is something between 5,000 and 80,000 a hectare per annum. So it's a drop in the ocean for farmers. I know there may be a skewed perception as to what farmers are earning in Africa, but the kind of farmers we're targeting and the ones that are currently engaging commercially with markets, they have these potential returns in place. So $15 a month service charges, they have no trouble paying it, and they were very enthusiastic to pay up. So basically, they pay their $15 a month, and that provides them with the grading service that allows them to improve their grading standards on farm, but it helps match them to the right market based on that quality. So they don't, this is to make sure they get the best possible price for their produce, but they also stratify and grade their produce appropriately, because one farmer won't grow all first-class produce. The reality is if a farmer's really good, they'll grow maybe 30 to 40% first-class produce for something like tomatoes, and then maybe another 50% to 55% will be second grade. But those really need to be targeted to separate markets, and that grading needs to happen at the farm gate so that can be targeted appropriately so it's delivered efficiently. So that's our sort of entry-level paid product. And our enterprise sort of service, which I've alluded to, is it's more of a planned production schedule. So we give farmers the entire production calendar, and we set up automated systems that basically send notifications out, collect data to allow farmers to self-certify that they are performing key intervention stages at each sort of stage in the crop production cycle, so that they produce the best quality crop, but they produce it in a predictable and repeatable manner. So we're sort of charging about $100 a month for that service at the moment, but we also take a 5% transaction fee for any assisted sales through our marketing platform that way. So that's basically what we offer. It's for the grading service first, but then the sort of our enterprise level subscription solution is the full production cycle plus assisted marketing. So it's helping farmers manage quality on the farm, but also once they've done that, intelligent access to markets. And by collectively coordinating farmers in our enterprise subscription solution, we effectively create these large-scale cooperatives that are able to serve markets more consistently. So this leads to better buyer relationships, and it ultimately it improves the pricing and the loyalty that the buyers will give to farmers. So there's a lot of back and forth. Unfortunately, because of this lack of standards and this lack of production capacity, it's sort of like a wild west in trading. And there's so many middlemen, and there's so many people trying to pass the buck, but also providing very little evidence for rejection. So we want to sort of be able to put farmers that work with us on a very sure footing about what the true price of what they've grown is. So we're improving price transparency from that perspective, because we help them understand the true value of what they've grown, as well as growing it more reliably and stably and collectively, so that they can you compete with these large-scale farms that have these very good relationships with commercial markets in Africa.
You've mentioned this quite a few times. I want to dive into the terminology of this sector, right? So can you just walk us through the difference between a grade A crop and a grade B crop? And does it differ depending on the type of crop that's actually being grown?
Yeah, so that's actually a really good question. And it outlines a bit the magnitude of the challenge that we're taking on. So depending on all the different statistics, I think I was looking at roughly what the FAO was recording globally in terms of crop types. And I think there are about 281 different types of crops, and that's not really specific for all the different cultivars. We should probably just take a good example like tomatoes, and it's where we're starting, because apart from the three major narcotics, I'd say it's the most valuable in terms of return for a farmer per land area, right? So if you grow tomatoes well, you can earn a very good living doing it. So we encourage farmers to focus on these high-value horticultural crops that will have a high rate of return for them, because they have such small portions of land. We want them to be thinking about maximizing their return per investment, but also their land use efficiency in terms of how much they can earn off their land. So with tomatoes, when you've got a first grade tomato, what you're actually doing there is you're trying to serve the retail market. And it doesn't really have anything to do with taste and nutrition, which is curious. The retail supermarkets that pay the premium price for these first grades want something that has a very long shelf life. So your first grade tomatoes, they need to be unblemished. They need to be partially ripe, ideally. So they talk about a champagne color in South Africa. But there's also, depending on the cultivars, you have different markings, particularly on the base of the fruit, that can indicate to you how ripe the produce is. But ultimately, you're not picking it full ripe, you're picking it semi-ripe. And one of the key things that determines quality and its stability during transport is how well you pack it. So packing has a huge influence on the price that a farmer gets for their produce at market, because it has such a huge impact on shelf life. It sounds odd and silly, but if you pack things neatly, they tend to survive very well on bumpy roads in Africa. So, and if you pack them well into good boxes and you don't stack them really high and very deep, you just get a better product. So that the first class tomato, nice uniform size, depending on the cultivar, this champagne to sort of green to semi-ripe color, and it needs to be well packed. Whereas second-class produce, they're a lot more flexible. So your proportion of spoilage and your proportion of visual imperfections is higher. So it's very low with first-class produce, but visual imperfections are more acceptable. The type of packing is more flexible, but also ripeness is a much more flexible concept. And the reason for that is these large markets have this ability to rapidly absorb and move produce to the local consumer. And the emergence of first and second class produce in Africa is interesting, because it points to two very different but very lucrative markets for farmers. And the second one, a lot of farmers seem to be ignoring. Everyone's trying to sell to high-end retail supermarkets because they think that's where all the money is. But that in reality, they're taking what is often a very small proportion of the farmers' pack out rate, so the total proportion of what they harvest that they sell. So I've mentioned it can be between 20 to 40%, but that's a very small proportion of what farmers have grown. This second class market goes off to the informal market where shelf life isn't really an issue because the majority of people buying these tomatoes don't have a fridge. Like that's, so they go home and on their way home, they're walking right down from the bus stop. They'll buy from a street vendor. They take that tomato home and they cook that on the day. So shelf life for the end consumer there is much less important. And what they care more about there is taste. So there's a really good market for well-graded second-class tomatoes that taste better, but ironically are far better for you than the ones that are picked and graded for in the retail supermarkets. But it has this much shorter shelf life. So that's one thing we're very curious about is understanding the nutritional content of this produce, because in reality, I'd say the working class populations in Africa are eating a much healthier diet because of their focus on taste and their lack of insistence on visual perfection. But again, most farmers don't understand the huge significance of this second class market and ultimately how much you can sell to it, but also the immense value there is to human health there, right? Because if you can feed a working class population really well, it solves so many. We know about this from all the diet problems that we have in developed economies, but if you look at the general health of populations that are fed with good sort of good healthy vegetables, there are a lot less problems in those societies when it comes to things like diabetes and typically sugar-related illnesses down to poor diet. So one of the things we want to understand more in the future is how do we maximize these positive benefits of these second-class markets? And are there ways that we could potentially lock in nutrition even further, so with food preservation, so we can try and make food in general healthier for longer and move societies away in Africa where there is this already this preponderance for taste rather than visual perfection? How could we progress society there even further to focus on nutrition and taste as a true value of a food product?
Thanks for that clarification, Oliver. And it's also interesting to hear that at least there's an opportunity for revenue in both markets. And the fact that the customers in both of these markets are distinct by the fact that maybe one is shopping at a retail store where they would have access to a fridge where they can store these tomatoes, for example, for a long period of time, versus those who most likely will not have access to refrigeration and therefore they want to consume their produce right away, and how taste is more of an important factor for them. That's very interesting to hear, and also great to hear that the farmers have access to people revenue streams. So I've got two questions. First of all, where are you guys currently based? Where have you established your first hub where you're offering these solutions to farmers? And the question beyond that is, do you have any success stories that you'd like to share of a small-scale farm that has been positively impacted by Karunga and the products that you offer them? And just sort of describe what their situation was before and after adopting your technology.
Sure. So I'd say we're actually in South Africa. So my co-founder lives in South Africa. He's a CA. He's been working in agtech there. But Tendai is sort of our boots on the ground. And he's integrated himself very firmly into farming culture in Gauteng, which is in and around the capital, Pretoria, but also the largest city there, which is Johannesburg. And we've built a nice beachhead cooperative of farmers. I think they're like 1,200, 1,500 farmers at the moment that we've done a lot of product testing with. And we've got a lot of very good feedback from them. And it's just been a very nice and easy way to get into markets in South Africa, because there are these very good buying markets in South Africa. And there's a lot of farmers that have solved I'd say because they're coming from semi-professional backgrounds, they've actually solved their credit line, which is another big pain point for farmers. And we can't solve everything at once. So we're working with farmers that we know are producing but just need help improving their standards. This is where there's a huge group of them that we can help within a certain geographic location, and that allows us to focus. Because despite that, farmers are spread over these huge geographic distances, and we really needed to find a nice place we could focus on where we wouldn't be traveling huge distances to visit farmers, because there's a lot of in-person visitation. We're building tech and there's remote tech, but ultimately farmers need, they still want this in-person contact, and they want this sort of assurance that there's someone behind the tech that's actually working for them. So we've built a lot of really good social trust in these networks by being visually present and being on the ground and working with farmers on their farms. And that's taken a tremendous amount of time. But I'd say one of interesting stories that we've got at the moment, so Noxolo, she's very young, but she signed up for our enterprise program where we're helping her go from seed to market. Because when they join up to our program, they get better access, better pricing, but also better access to quality inputs. So we're helping them to validate what the really good stuff is from the snake oil in the markets. And she's just like, this is amazing. She keeps telling us, like, I was so uncertain about how I should be moving forward and what I need to be focusing on. And a lot of people just aren't sure what they should be planting. So we're just saying, we know there's going to be a market for cabbages. You're starting off. Let's get you growing this particular cabbage hybrid. Our seed provider, Sakata, they've got this really nice hybrid called Optima. It's going to give you really nice stable head production over time. And she's just over the moon about this, right? She can't work out how we're making it sound so simple, but it's, to her, it's the best value for money she's ever put in. And Tendai, to his credit, he goes out to a lot of these farmers and he works with them to get them using the tech properly, but also to help them understand things that we can't quite currently convey using technology yet. Because there is a need for agricultural service assistance to help them achieve this standardization of quality. So we're working out how much of that we can digitize, but we're coming to a very strong realization now. We're going to need some sort of agricultural extension service that we provide to farmers that embeds into this sort of technology framework that we're building for them. But yeah, Noxola is a very good example. She was new to farming. She wasn't really sure how it was going to work, but she's getting going now. She's already planting. We've got her seedlings, and she's got a very clear guideline. And we're confident, you know, we've done this with other farmers. We know she's going to do really well despite her lack of experience. So it's a nice, safe entry point into the agricultural market if you're new and you don't know where to go. But ultimately, I think it's going to benefit a lot of farmers, even if they're seasoned professionals, because we're helping them to bring standardization to what can at sometimes be a fairly erratic process.
Okay, and connecting this back to Kuranga's goal and your mission with Tendai. So Kuranga aims to enhance food security and reduce food waste, as you said. Are there any other sustainability measures or practices that you incorporate or plan to incorporate your operations anytime soon? Or is the goal and focus just food waste reduction / supporting farmers in this small-scale farmers markets to improve their profitability and their productivity?
So one of the things, from a sustainability perspective, and I don't get a chance to talk about this a lot because I'd say people interested in ag tech aren't necessarily always focused on this, but I did my fellowship. I was actually stationed at Seward Park, which is one of the, I'd say, the premier ecology and evolution, but also conservation research centers in the UK. And I was surrounded by a lot of ecologists and conservationists. And this is at the time where everyone's worrying about ecosystem destruction. And I was trying to track the practicality of protecting ecosystems by trying to stop society from doing certain things. So stop cutting down trees, stop digging up oil, digging up coal. And I realized that trying to stop a human being from doing something that leads to them improving their quality of life is a very challenging thing to do. But I knew from my experience in agriculture that one of the best things you can do to protect ecosystems is to make land use efficiency as high as it possibly can be, right? So if we focus on yield and we focus particularly on this large swathe of land that is already committed to agriculture and improving its production efficiency, simply by being able to grow more food, we preserve a huge amount of potential land that would have otherwise been cut down and allocated to agriculture because no one was looking at the existing land and its productivity potential. So like at heart, we're actually conservationists because we have this relentless focus on land use efficiency. And how do we drive this up as high as possible to ensure that we're getting as much as we can off that land? I think one of the things we want to transition towards in the future is how do we do that in a sustainable way? So we are promoting the best sort of agricultural practice we've been able to identify so far that is healthy for humans on the farm, but also healthy for the environment around and healthy for the people that are eating the food. But because of my background in research, I see there's huge potential for improving soil health, particularly by doing really simple things like burying, you know, carbon. So there's a huge opportunity, I think, in terms of diversifying farmer revenue in the future by bringing in carbon credits, but also by burying carbon and burying organic matter and putting that in the soil to improve soil health. And the knock-on effects that you get from that in terms of general plant health and the reduction of the need for pesticides is tremendous. So there's some amazing trials that are happening in Africa at the moment that are just, if you go onto these farms and you say, how have you been doing this? No, there's no way you haven't been using chemicals to achieve this level of growth and this level of productivity and plant health. So I think there's some amazing new trials and technologies being developed, but we need to find a way to scale that appropriately so yield is still maximized, because ultimately land use efficiency will reduce land conversion, basically, right? So if we focus on yield, but we also learn how to integrate these new forms of technology and these new forms of management practices that help us to reduce the use of fungicides and pesticides in general, we will be able to help build healthier farming ecosystems, and we'll be able to reduce the negative impacts that farming has on adjacent and downstream ecosystems. So that's something we definitely want to look at in the future. There's some very low-hanging fruit there, but right now we're focused on this closing this yield gap in these markets because we see this as a huge potential for improving food security, but also just reducing habitat destruction in the future.
And on that, how do you see your efforts with Kurunga and the future efforts that you just described? How do you see that impacting African agriculture in the next 5 to 10 years?
Again, going back to this concept of land use efficiency. So Nigeria is the largest producer and exporter of tomatoes, according to some statistics that I managed to pull off the FAO's website. But their yields per hectare, the average yield per hectare of tomatoes in Nigeria appears to be about 3 tons per hectare. Whereas we know that using good agricultural practice in Africa, a small-scale farmer can easily achieve between 60 to 80 tons per hectare of tomatoes. So if we simply went in and focused on tomatoes in Nigeria, we could increase production by a factor of 20 at least of this one crop. And it's a highly nutritious crop. There's huge potential value. But also, if we improve management practice, we could significantly improve the production levels in Africa and have absolutely huge impact on global food security, right? Because there's such huge potential for improving yields in these areas where farming is already ongoing. But we just need to make sure that, oh, we're doing that. We're channeling the food to the correct market so we can capture that nutrition and make sure it benefits people. And we're feeding people with that food as well. So yeah, in five years, you know, I'd love to see us seeing all of these inefficiencies and raising yields by, I'd say, at least 2 to 3 fold on ideally something like 200,000 hectares. And I think that's very achievable with where we're going and the scalability of what we're trying to achieve using data, using tech, and our ability to reach 100,000 farmers that are only allocating 2 hectares of produce to that and closing their yield gaps by raising their theoretical ceiling, I think that's very achievable. And we could produce millions of tons more food on that land with sort of those very modest projections that I've just outlined.
Well, that's a very ambitious vision, Oliver. The improvements you're proposing could address some very critical issues that would be a huge benefit to local communities and food security overall, as you said. If you could achieve that, I think that would be a tremendous accomplishment for Karanga. So we wish you the very best of luck as you push forward towards that objective, and I'm very excited to see how far you and Tendai take it. We're back here with Oliver Windrum, CTO of Karanga, an agri-tech startup that aims to improve the outcome of small farmers in Africa through data-driven approaches, AI, and continuous support to help them navigate the marketplace in which they sell their crops. So, Oliver, it's been great having you on the podcast. It's great learning about your journey. You spent a lot of time in research, as you mentioned earlier. And you've sort of pivoted into the startup ecosystem with your co-founder, Tendai. So I'm going to ask you 2 questions as we wrap up here on the podcast. The first question I want to ask you is just addressing the fact that you and Tendai grew up together in Zimbabwe before embarking on this venture. So can you share some of your memories from your childhood or earlier years that highlights the bonds you two have? And how did these experiences sort of influence the way you work together on Karanga?
Yeah, so Tendai and I, we went to secondary school together, and it was a boarding school, and it was quite one of those sort of, it was quite a strict, regimented boarding school, and there was a lot of structure to it, but they wanted to build and mold people in particular ways there. And I think sort of Tendai was, we were both fairly smart, but we were also interested in similar things. So we ended up, we did a lot of music. We were doing a lot of music together. We did sports together and stuff like that. But ultimately, I think we were friends, but maybe we didn't realize how similar we were at the time. And I think maybe our schooling molded us into very similar people. So we come from very different backgrounds. So I'm European by descent. Tendai is Shona, and he grew up in Harare. I grew up on a farm, so he's a city boy, I'm a farm boy. But ultimately, we got thrown in this mixing pot at school, and you spend so much time, we were all in the same classes doing the same O and A levels, and we were doing a lot of the same extracurricular activities. So ultimately, I think it molds very similar people. One of the things I was astounded by is how similar Tendai and I actually are in terms of our ideals, our outlooks in life. And it's possible that we're 2 peas in a pod, but I think we were molded to a certain extent when we were at school, just because we had these common interests. And so we find that working together, we think along very similar lines. I won't say we're the kind of people that finish each other's sentences, but it's very easy to align on objectives. And whenever we have discussions, we always want to double check that we're thinking along the same lines, but we very rarely seem to deviate from each other's line of thinking, which is incredibly useful when you have a co-founder to be that well aligned with someone. And I've worked with a lot of other people in the past, and I'm generally quite a difficult person to get along with, if I'm honest, but getting along with Tendai is really useful. Yeah, I think he enjoys my company too. So and the fact that we're from these two slightly different worlds really makes building trust and support in places like South Africa really useful. So we've gained a lot of really good social capital and a lot of trust in these communities that we've delved into, because we've taken time to sort of understand what people are doing, but we present this really nice united front where we are bringing two very different perspectives in Africa together to try and build a solution for everyone. So yeah, we work really well together.
Well, that's really great to hear, Oliver. Oftentimes when people ask, okay, what's your relationship with your co-founder? They say something that would give them some sort of advantage. I've heard people say, oh, we think differently, and that's somehow an asset because we can check each other. But it sounds like you guys, there are any differences in thinking, it's not by huge deviation. I think that's what really is very key when you're working with somebody, right? And it helps you stay on track, and there's less of a need to sort of compromise because you're mostly aligned on the same thing. So I can definitely see how that's been an advantage for you, and I'm sure you feel very lucky to have a friend as a co-founder who sees the world the same way you do. And I'm sure you're very happy that you have an asset like Tendai alongside you. Now, the last question I have before we wrap up is, what is one piece of wisdom that you've gained from your experience working on Kuronga?
So yeah, I think it's probably one of these things. It's a very simple statement. It's like, don't get lost in the tech. So I'm the CTO, right? I do all the tech development, and it's definitely useful, but you need to ground it in reality and make sure you're implementing and solving a real world problem and that you focus on that real world problem. And sometimes you've got to recognize where tech definitely isn't the solution, but where you marry practical solutions with tech is what really builds something that's going to succeed and get wins. So yeah, that would be my simple advice, is tech's useful, but it's not the only thing.
I do resonate with that statement as well, Oliver, how there's always this tendency to just apply tech to everything. See a lot of ventures in developing countries now trying to provide some tech solutions because they're trying to push this digital revolution. But sometimes solutions might not require such a heavy tech focus. Sometimes solutions are more subtle. Sometimes solutions are more personal. Some solutions require just a tweak of an analog process that might not lend well to tech, depending on the communities that you're focusing, of course. So I see where you're coming from with that opinion as well. And it's clear that regarding the human connection that you emphasized, these small performers do value that human connection, and your work with Tendai being around in South Africa, making sure that connection is maintained. I see how that's of importance for you, and I'm glad that you guys are doing your best not to fall into that trap. That being said, that just about wraps it up for us here at the Beta Mode. Oliver, it was great having you on the podcast, learning about your journey and your experience growing up in Zimbabwe and how that shaped the work that you're doing now, and how things are sort of aligned with you regarding your work with Tendai and your past experiences. I mean, I learned a lot from this conversation, and I'm sure our audience will learn a lot as well. So I just wanted to wish you, Kuronga, your co-founder, Tendai, the very best of luck and all you hope to accomplish in the future. Thank you for joining us, Oliver.
Brilliant. Well, thanks for inviting me. It's been great chatting to you.